Welcome to the Business Trendsetter Podcast, where we talk about trends and how to grow your business. My name is Manny Turan.
And I'm Adam Hartung.
We are Spark Partners. We're here every week to bring you news and concepts about trends and why they're so important to your business. And one of the things we talk about a lot is demographics, and in particular, how the change in demographics should be recognized and exploited, really, if you want to grow your business. And we've talked about demographics from the U.S. standpoint, but today the concept is the demographics from the world stage. And there's a couple of major changes happening with demographics that not a lot of people know about, and that is the decline in the population of China and the increase in the population of India. So Adam, let's talk about those things in the context of business and how it pertains to why should we care? I mean, what's the big deal?
Right. You know, in planning, a long time ago, we used to say, don't worry about planning except for the things that you can do something about. When business planning started a long time ago, 40 years ago, that was kind of the idea. And now increasingly we're seeing that what's really important in planning is to think about those things that you can't control. That the things we can control, we're getting better at managing all the time. So what we can control, we're pretty good at planning. It's the things that get out of control, the things we can't control that get us into trouble. COVID-19, we couldn't control it. And sure as the world, it caused us a lot of trouble. Supply chains got shut down. It was a big issue. Because we couldn't control it. We weren't prepared for it. Now, to some extent, that tells you what? Prepare for more stuff. And that means you have to think about other stuff. I can remember just a decade ago when, I think it was about a decade ago, I guess it's been more than that now, when George H.W. Bush had a real paranoia about bird flu hitting the United States. And he was scared it was going to be really a pandemic and under his administration. And so he prepared for the bird flu. And he set up an office of preparedness for pandemic, okay? And so he was really thinking outside the box in that way. He was thinking what could happen in the world beyond the borders of the U.S. and could prepare for it. And kudos to him for doing that, because it stayed in place until Trump became president. He shut the office down, and that's when we needed it the most, right? Then when we needed an office of preparedness for a pandemic, it had been closed down by the administration. So here's the thing. Okay, we're going to talk about demographics outside the United States today. And the reason is it will have an impact on all business people. Everyone will see this, and we'll see it over the next decade and definitely over the next generation. There's no way to avoid it. It's a demographics move like a ship in the ocean. It's big, it's heavy, and it's on course, and you can't turn it very well. And it takes decades, but when you do turn it, it has a big impact. So let's talk about China and India first. For years, China was the most populous country on the planet. Right. And we got used to that. We got used to that comment. So when we normalized trade with China under Nixon, we started to do some business with them. The idea was we don't want to avoid 1.1 billion people on the planet. That was a big marketplace. And let's figure out how to integrate them into the global economy. What happened, though, was that during the Chairman Mao's regime and shortly after, there was this one child policy that went into place. That their idea of modernizing the country was to have fewer children. In other words, we want to slow down this birth rate and not have so many children and try to work better at feeding our own population, improving our population. And so China undertook this proposition of one child, and it reduced the birth rate and at the same time gave them more resources to invest in infrastructure. So if you go to China, what you see is a country that has a lot of infrastructure, trains, planes, automobiles, big buildings, air-conditioned buildings, good working conditions, those sorts of things. But that policy that was set up 50 years ago now has the implication that there are not nearly as many women of childbearing age in China as there are in India. And the ones in China, what did you say that the birth rate was for a woman in China, the expectation?
So it's 1.28. So that basically means 1.28 for every 100 people.
Yeah. So that's not even replacement rate.
No.
Not even close to replacement rate. But now let's take a look at India. So the reason, again, we're doing these two is that this year, 2023, India will surpass China as the most populous country on the planet. They will go, India this year will go to 1.428 million people by summertime. And in other words, 1.428 billion. And then China will have 1.425 billion people in their country. So what's the birth rate of women in India?
It is 2.05.
Right. So it's bigger than the replacement rate, right? And simultaneously, because they haven't the policy in China of the one child rule means that the population has aged dramatically. We've already talked about this aging a couple, three times on this program. So we have a much older population in China. So that means the women there are predominantly not of childbearing age. So even if you could up the number of children they wanted to have from this unreplaceable, you know, not replaceable rate of 1.28 to 2, there's just simply not enough women of age to maintain the population. So the population of China is in a position that it's like that it will go down. It will get smaller. Meanwhile, the population of India is going to grow. They're going to get substantially larger. Now, the other thing to keep in mind is if we add the population of those two countries together, we get 2.9 billion people, right? And yeah, almost 3 billion people. That is a third of the total population of the world. That's pretty dramatic when you think massive, about it. Yeah. Two countries with a third of the population of the entire planet. Now, again, people could say, well, I don't understand why that matters. Well, let's think about how, what people think, how things can go when, just based on population. It wasn't that many years ago that we undertook support of a war where Iraq and Iran were at war for quite a bit period of time. I don't know if you remember this.
And, I do.
We considered Saddam Hussein our friend at the time, and we gave him guns. And what happened was there were so many more Iranians than there were Iraqis that the Iranians would give their soldiers wooden guns and send them in hordes and waves to just go try to the point they say, we're going to get win this battle because the Iraqi soldiers will run out of bullets before we run out of men. And we will just crush them with people. Now, that's a horrific example, but it is the way people start to think. I have all these people. I can throw all these people at doing anything that I want to do. So I was in India about, it must have been about 15 years ago now, and at the Indian Institute of Technology for a conference. And I remember I was fascinated because I went outside and they were putting up a building not far away. And the building, normally when we see somebody putting up a building of 8, 9 stories, something like that, you know, you'll see a lot of cranes and that kind of equipment. But what happened is they were building this building out of blocks, and they were making the blocks down on the ground. So they I don't know that it was cement or clay, I'm not sure, but it was they were making these blocks. They would make them, form them, dry them, had them all there on the ground. Then what happened was women would pick up two of the blocks and set them on their heads, and they would proceed then to climb up the ladders, 6, 7 stories, carrying blocks, which they would take the blocks off, and then they had another set of ladders that they would take down to the ground. And this process did not stop. I was told it went on 24 hours a day, that these women were walking up the ladders and carrying, dropping off two blocks. Now, we couldn't imagine doing it that way in the United States.
No, not at all.
But the reason they do it is because in that country, the labor is so, there's so much labor compared to equipment that they use labor in this sort of way that we would just consider horrific to try to work people that way in the United States. But it tells you something about how they value the society and how what they say. They say, look, you have to work in order to eat, and we're going to make you work. Now, if you live in that society, you would start saying to yourself, hey, I think it might be a better way. You know, I don't really want to spend 8 or 9 hours a day, 7 days a week, carrying two blocks on my head up a ladder all day long. I mean, obviously, you're not going to live a long time if that's your lifestyle. And so that means that people want to get out, right? They want to leave. They want to go somewhere. And so this idea that immigration can be thwarted is just not true. So, when you just have that many people, the reality is that you start saying, wow, people want to.
Well, here's a couple of interesting numbers. And so you mentioned Iraq and Iran. And in 2020, their birth rates were Iraq was 3.6 and Iran was 1.7. And so that basically flipped on its end. Now, a couple other things is Italy has a really low birth rate of 1.2, whereas and Japan has one that is 1.3. Now, if you can imagine, those countries are, especially Japan, they're very, very isolationist. So if they're to maintain their culture, if they're to maintain their population base, they've got to be at least 2.1, anything above 2 aggregate. And right now, that's in danger, right? I mean, even the U.S. is 1.6. So in order to maintain our culture, I mean, at least we have some level of immigration, but even that is somewhat limited. So just a couple of things to keep in mind when we look at the actual numbers.
By the way, while you've got that, what's the birth rate in America?
1.6.
Okay, all right. So we're below sustainability.
Yeah.
We're not going to be able to sustain. We're going to have to, the only way you solve an unsustainable birth rate is through immigration. Otherwise, you become smaller.
Right. So and that's the thing. I mean, with Japan in particular, they have almost zero immigration, right? They don't like to have quote unquote foreigners. And the same thing to a lesser degree in Italy. There's villages in Italy that'll pay you money. They'll give you a place to live, and they'll give you like $30,000 a year to come and to make babies, basically.
Yeah. So let's take this kind of, again, let's draw the picture out. I want to go through the top 10 countries in the world in terms of population. India, 1.4 billion. China, 1.4 billion. Third is the USA with 340 million. So we need to recognize we're one quarter the population of each of those two countries. The fourth one is Indonesia with 277 million. Pakistan with 238. Nigeria with 221. Brazil, 216, and then Bangladesh, 172. You notice you don't hear England, Germany, France, Italy, Spain. None of the European countries are on there. None of the Eastern European countries are on there. So what we have to prepare for here are these developing countries rapidly reaching the point that they cannot support their own populations. Last summer, we had floods in Pakistan that killed millions of people. And we know that these floods will repeat because we can take a look at how the climate is today. I'm not arguing, making an argument. Just say we look at the weather, we look at the forecast, we look at the rains, we look at how the temperature is causing the rains to change. And we know that Bangladesh and Pakistan are going to have tremendous flooding. What's going to happen to those people? They're either going to die or they're going to have to move. Where are they going to move? Well, that's a question we need to start thinking about now. Some of them will probably go to Europe, but some of them are going to want to come to the United States. If we continue trying to pretend like this isn't going to happen, pretty soon there are going to just be boatloads, waves of people. Today we have what we call a river of people coming from Guatemala to the United States across the southern border of Mexico. We think of that as being just a horrific problem. There is nowhere near as many people trying to get out of Guatemala as there are trying to get out of some of these other countries. We're looking at what would be a canoe compared to a battleship if these other countries really started getting into a net outflow of immigration.
Yeah.
But the other part of this is we have to think about what could we do? Should we be shipping jobs to those countries? For years, we took advantage of this differential in demographics by exporting jobs, right? We exported a lot of manufacturing jobs to China. We exported a lot of jobs in engineering, publishing, printing. There was a lot of businesses, textiles that we imported to India. And for a long time, we took advantage of it that way. But the reality is, will that continue to happen? Because what we saw, what happened with COVID, we don't know that long supply chains are very risky and that things can go wrong and you're not going to be able to get your products if you've got these long supply chains. So is that going to continue to be a good way for us to operate? Let's also take a look at another country you don't see on there, and that's Russia. If you wind the clock back to the 1960s, in the 70s, we had the Soviet Union. And the Soviet Union combined a whole bunch of countries in Eastern Europe, and it made them as large as the United States. In fact, they were bigger than the United States. So what we would refer to as Russia really was the Soviet Union, very, very different, and it had a lot more people in it. When the Soviet Union collapsed during the Reagan administration, we saw that the population of Russia becomes much smaller. Now you start realizing that with barely 140 million people, we start to get a better understanding of a behavior of a Putin. He's at risk of becoming, not very important on the world stage. He's got nuclear power. He's used to being treated as one of the big three. And he starts saying, what? Hey, I want to continue to be one of the big three. The only way I can do that is to put the Soviet Union back together again. He goes and grabs Crimea. Now he's trying to grab the Ukraine. And we see him trying to broker a deal with China so that somehow he could try to get more munitions. Because he's trying to say, are we the big three or are we not the big three? And I'm not going to be able to get there if I don't have some help. So that means that the odds that Putin's just going to give up are pretty low. Because what he's afraid of is that Russia will become a backwater country. Unable to sustain its position with cosmonauts and all the things that they've been able to do as a country, as Russia, for its population. So this impact of this is going to help. Is going to impact all of us. we got used to shipping technology jobs to Russia and the Ukraine. Yeah. We had engineering and coding being done in those countries. Well, Ukraine's going to take a decade to rebuild, even if this war slows down. And Russia's not going to be trusted anymore. So you're not going to be able to go to those places. Are we going to immigrate a number of those people to the USA so that we have them? Or what are we going to do? You know, it's not like I go to colleges and I hear that people in vast hordes are signing up for coding jobs. And we still have a lot of the native-born Americans going to university, and they're not just studying science, engineering, those types of backgrounds. But what we do see is that the immigrants that come from foreign countries like Nigeria, like Pakistan, like India and China, that is what they study. They come in studying these scientific and innovative areas. And one of the worst problems we have right now is that when people graduate with a PhD in these programs, they often leave. They go back to their country. And then what happens is we get a brain drain out of the United States. My son has a PhD in bioengineering, and he's made it quite clear to me that he plans to move to Germany in the next year. And the reason is that he says that just, you know, in the United States, you just don't have the opportunities to get the grants, to get the funding, to get the corporate support that you have, that he would have in Germany. It's going to be much better for his development of the what he works on if he goes there. So he's talking about the fact that he's going to leave. If we're educating all these people just to send them back to these countries?
Here's a couple of other pieces of news as it pertains to demographics. So, and birth rates, I mean. If you look at the top 30 countries with the highest birth rates, Niger, Somalia, Niger's got 6.9, Somalia 6.4. The top 30, with the exception of Afghanistan, are all in Africa, and they all have above a 4-point birth rate. So that means for every two people, they're having like at least four kids, right? And so if you're looking at the other side of the coin, so the ones with the lowest birth rates, South Korea has 0.8. Let's see here. Other ones of questions, Spain 1.2, Italy 1.2. You know, so we're talking about a significant shift in how the world's going to look by the time, and you know, in the next 30 years, it's going to be a different world. Just, I mean, you can't get away from that. I mean, we can't put a cork back in it, but at the same time, you can be smart about how you actually do business and set up business to recognize that these countries are going to be a force to be reckoned with, at least when it comes to population.
In the 60s and 70s, the United States was the number one lender of resources and provider of resources to the developing world. And we used that because we said, look, these are poor countries. They need some help. At the end of the 70s, as we go into the Reagan administration, it became more of a focus on investing in the United States. We said that our bridges were bad, our roads were bad, and Reagan came in with a promise to fix the infrastructure, invest in the U.S., and build back up the military, which a promise of which he made good on, okay? But in doing that, we cut dramatically our investments overseas. That has been replaced by China. They implemented a policy called the Belt and Road Initiative about 15 years ago, and they have gone particularly to South America and particularly to Africa, where they've gone to countries and said, look, we will give you money to build roads and dams and all these good things that will help your country to get better. And we'll provide the engineers that will come in and help you to design it and help you to build it. So where we used to think of America as the country that went around the world building these things for people, we have really been replaced in a lot of ways by China. Why? Well, because they look at their population decline and they say, hey, it'd be really good if we had all these high birth rate countries like Nigeria owing us, being indebted to us. Yeah. And sure as the world, some of these countries have been facing situations where they cannot repay their loans. We set up the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank 45 years ago to deal with problems in emerging countries where they had debt problems. And the World Bank would come in and help them restructure their finances. Today, the World Bank and the IMF have gone into these countries and said, okay, China, you're going to take a bit of a hit here on this loan because you've gave them too much money. And China said, no, we're not going to play by those rules. We're going to starve these people out if we have to, but we're going to take, you know, they're either going to pay us back for this or we're going to take our road back. We're not going to let anybody drive on them. So what's happening is they're on the international stage gaining a lot more influence. And again, as long as we're sitting here in the United States just being happy and not paying the look externally, we're not realizing that all this lithium that we need to get, for our batteries. Foodstuffs, you know, cocoa, coffee, chocolate, you know, cocoa for chocolate, gum. There's so many products that we consume both as edibles and as we'll use in manufacturing processes, and what are used in manufacturing processes around the world that end up being in the products like telephones, cell phones, I mean, you know, computers, cars, rubber tires, all these things are, you know, increasingly coming from these countries where they're going to be not indebted to the United States, but to the Chinese. And that puts the Chinese in a position of starting to shut off the supply chain.
Yeah.
Additionally, go back to the Japan comment that you made earlier. For 15 years, I've been watching the Chinese build islands in the Sea of Japan and the South China Sea. And in the South, I pay attention to that because my father was in World War II and he was in the South China Sea. And he used to tell me all these stories, being on a battleship for 2 years, fighting these battles out in the Pacific and the South China Sea. And so I've just watched it. And I watched them build these islands. And for years, people said, why are they building islands? And it didn't look that, like, to me, like it was much of a question. Sure as the world, they're going to put military installations out there. And they've started to do that. So what we see is it would not be that hard. It's not out of the question for China to one day say, hey, Japan, we're going to annex you. You're going to become part of our country. Now, it probably wouldn't happen by war. It would probably happen more by conversations between the Chinese and the Japanese, and the Chinese saying, look, you know, you need support because how many people are in Japan and what's your birth rate? How old is your population? And you need help. And as the United States, they're to help you out, or we are. We look how close we are. Look how proximate we are to you and how we can work together. And they're pushing the same thing, and we'll keep hearing this in Taiwan. You know, they're kind of saying, well, okay, how aggressively are people protecting the Ukraine? Well, dependent on NATO, right? We had all these countries in Europe that supports us, and then mm-hmm. NATO has been a big force in terms of trying to help Ukraine stifle the ambitions that are down in Russia. But there is no equivalent in Taiwan. There's no, you know, the ASEAN countries have not formed together into a NATO-like structure. When we tried to have the Pan-Pacific Partnership, it got canceled, you know, under the Trump administration. It didn't even go forward. So that, again, this view of us as America and not looking externally as leaving China sitting out there with an opportunity to expand while the Taiwanese are in fear. The Japanese have righteous reasons to be fearful as well at the same time. So I think what we're trying to get across to people is do not expect the future to look like the past.
No,
and you're going to have to expect that if America is going to try to remain a strong country, we're going to have to immigrate. A lot of immigration.
Yeah.
Now we can get smart about it, you know, and we can start saying, we're going to set up for training. People come here and we'll give them training jobs. You know, don't just have people show up with no idea what they're going to do. You know, last time we brought a lot of people to this country with nothing to do, they were called slaves. And we're still suffering trying to figure out how we can try to pull people that had no background, no training, and no support to a good standard of living, right? Reparations are one of the discussions we have. But the reality is when you bring in a lot of people and you don't give them a support structure, it's hard for them to improve, right? As Martin Luther King said, you can't pull yourself up by the bootstraps if you have no boots. The reality is that people coming from India today often are from the wealthier families of India. Right. So they come here with money. They can support themselves in college. They can support themselves in early jobs. Then they get a good job. Then they start sending money back to India so that they can have their relatives come back over again, right? That's been a very successful approach. We call it the diaspora of the Indian nation. And we, you know, today you have an Indian-born person as the head of Google. We're getting far more common. They're probably, I don't have the statistic at hand, but just my appearance is that there may be more Indian CEOs of Fortune 500 countries than there are women as head of Fortune 500 countries in the United
States. Oh, that's for sure. That's absolutely for sure.
So yeah. You know, how are we looking at this and what can we expect? And I think as small business people, we have to start to get the small and medium-sized business people. We have to think very hard about what are our supply chains? What are our dependencies? And start saying, are there dependencies here that could put my entire business at risk? And if so, how do I deal with them? The second thing I think we got to think about really strong is we've got to start thinking about training programs. For years, you know, when I was going to school, I went to high school in the 1970s. And I was in a more rural area in the central part of the country, the Kansas-Oklahoma border. And every school I knew had a vocational technical program. And that was a separate building. And it was primarily for boys. And you could go over and you took classes in welding and framing and carpentry and plumbing and all kinds of trades. And the idea was when you were in high school, if you weren't college bound, you didn't think you were going to college, then you went to the VOTEC and you did all the requirements for a high school degree. You know, but you do half a day doing arithmetic and English in those classes, and half a day in the Go Tech Center learning a trade. We've abolished all those. We've done away with all.
Pretty rare.
Yeah. And they were everywhere. That's what I want to be clear about. They were everywhere. In my graduating class of 145, I think about, 20 of us went to college, and then most of the rest of the people were either agrarian or they went into a trade of some kind, right? And someone went to work in factories. but we quit thinking that way. We started thinking that, okay, factories were bad things, send factories to foreign countries. People that work in factories are less than people. So don't let your children be a worker in a factory. You need to have them go do something else. We have to change that mindset. We definitely have to change the training mindset. If you're a business, I worked with a company out of Minnesota that had, they did workflow products for the insurance industry. Very technical kind of a business. You know, workflow's got all the software, and you're moving data in, you're moving it around, packaging it up, moving with people. And they were using machine learning. And they realized that the only way they could grow was to bring in people from foreign countries that had math degrees. And they were in Eden Prairie, Minnesota. And so they were able to go and recruit for people to come to Minnesota with the kinds of backgrounds that they needed so that they could continue to grow their business. And this was a typical small business. You know, it wasn't even $100 million in revenue. But they built a team of 15 of the best, what we would now call AI experts. And they started it 15 years ago. And now they're in great shape. That's what we need to be thinking about.
Right. Well, I'll get on my semi-political pulpit here, which obviously not. We can't wait for the government to solve some of these problems. As business owners and as business executives, we got to find ways around it. We got to be smart about it. I mean, a lot of companies went out and did outsourcing of their, some of their customer service, like you're talking about, right? And oftentimes they found that there is some cultural or even language issues that causes problems. So what we're inviting you here as listeners of our podcast to think about is maybe use AI, maybe think about how you actually outsource or even near source. I know of a couple of companies that are using, they call it Mormon moms, quote unquote. So this is people that are working in their homes, spread across rural America, that in a very asynchronous way can go in, spend an hour here, an hour there doing this data processing, data entry and data crunching, where you still need people involved. And by doing so, they're actually able to be, again, by leveraging the asynchronous nature of this, they're able to leverage these primarily mothers that are working from home that are, in between naps and this and that. And I mean, it's just a different business model. So the world's changing, and I think the sooner people adapt and recognize and do the scenario planning, which we've talked about ad nauseum, they can actually gain benefit from it.
Being from the part of the world, middle of the country as I was, I now, if I go back to that part of the world, constantly see towns gone. Towns. There were towns at one point, but there's nobody living them anymore. They've just gone away because people moved to larger cities. And what we saw was that cities that there was like the big city, like take for example Tucson and Phoenix, right? People kind of look down on a Tucson and think I'm better of a Phoenix. But we should reverse that thinking now. You can say to yourself, hey, you know what? If I'm in a Tucson or a Wichita or a town that maybe isn't on that top list of favorite places people want to go all the time, but they're great cities, you start saying, hey, why don't we put up manufacturing here? Now, you're probably not going to get a silicon plant, right? You're not going to get the billion-dollar big hit because the people in Washington won't necessarily think that way. But you can go out and lobby to say, hey, why don't we build electronic chargers for cars and other componentry for electric vehicles? Why don't I get close to a Tesla or a GM and say, what are the parts that you need? If you're in a Toledo or if you're in a Pontiac, Michigan, these are towns that have been hurt by the concentration of manufacturing, the concentration of work, by pushing people towards the big cities. We're saying everybody's got to be in the same place where they work. We create a concentration. But what you're saying with your comment there is that we learned in the pandemic it doesn't have to be that way. So now it gives a real opportunity for even, not even towns as big as Tucson. You can look at your Enid, Oklahoma's, 35 or 40,000 people. Pawnee, Ponca. I mean, these are towns that were important in the agrarian area, lost a lot of that importance, but now are well positioned, in order to put in call centers. Instead of having the call center in India, recruit people, bring them in, give them language training, give them some computer training, and set up a call center in a place like Indian, Oklahoma, which is a very affordable place to live.
They did that in my hometown of Douglas, Arizona. They actually brought in a call center. They the city owned an old supermarket and moved everybody into the supermarket. And about 9 months ago, maybe a year ago, they actually went and made everybody remote. So now people can work. And again, they're leveraging the trends. And the city's taking back that building and they're doing something else with it. But point being is that if you want to be competitive, you got to think, you got to get outside the box, then think, right?
I mean, we're seeing the tech industry laying off tens of thousands of people right now. And a big reason is because those people cost $100,000 plus per year. You can't live in Silicon Valley, and there's no house in Silicon Valley available for less than $1 million, right? And that's just crazy by standards of other parts of the world. So whenever these immigrants come in, the last thing we want to do is try to pull these immigrants into these very costly centers, like your Dallas-Fort Worth, like your Houston, like your Phoenix. These are expensive places to live, expensive places to open up businesses, expensive places to undertake training. But instead, put them in Reno, right? Go to these other towns where we could, and that's what I'm trying to encourage our audience out there, is to say, if you're in a Phoenix, great for you. But maybe your next expansion shouldn't be just down the street. It should be in Tucson, right? If you like doing business in Arizona, go to Tucson. Or, the great city that's in the mountains on the northern end of the state.
Flagstaff.
Flagstaff. Lovely city. Beautiful city. You know, doesn't have the hot summers. Has wonderful weather, in my opinion. You know, Flagstaff's a great place. Those are the places where you should be thinking about going. If you're in Denver, same thing. Why not think about going to Pueblo, Colorado, or think about going to Flagstaff, right? If you're in DFW, why don't you go out into the Panhandle? You know, look for these ways to put train people and put them to work in a lot of these jobs that can be done in a remote manner.
Absolutely. And I think it just behooves our listeners to really think about demographics as it pertains to birth rate and look where the shifts in the next 30, 40, 50 years. I mean, they're happening now. It's not like it's some distant horizon. We're actually on that horizon and we're just approaching it. So with that, Adam, thanks for the commentary and the discussion and the conversation. And we'll talk to you next week.
Yeah, I just want to remind everybody, this worker problem is not going away in the next 20 years. It's time to get ahead of it. Watch where the demographics are going and start rethinking how you're going to get work done.
Very well said. Cheers.